Chapter 57. The second engineer moved along a catwalk between the massive fuel tanks that towered two decks above him. He was running a routine maintenance check for any trace of leakage in the pipes that transferred the oil to the boilers that provided steam for the Leonid Andreev's 27,000 horsepower turbines. He whistled to himself, his only accompaniment coming from the hum of the turbogenerators beyond the forward bulkhead. Every so often he wiped a rag around a pipe fitting or valve, nodding in satisfaction when it came away clean. Suddenly he stopped and cocked an ear. The sound of metal striking against metal came from a narrow walkway leading off to his right. Curious, he walked slowly, quietly, along the dimly lit access. At the end, where the walkway turned and passed between the fuel tanks and the inner plates of the hull, he paused and peered into the gloom. A figure in a steward's uniform appeared to be attaching something to the side of the fuel tank. The second engineer approached, stepping softly, until he was only 10 feet away. "What are you doing here?" he demanded. The steward slowly turned and straightened. The engineer could see he was Oriental. The white uniform was soiled with grime, and a seaman's duffel bag lay open behind him on the walkway. The steward flashed a wide smile and made no effort to reply. The engineer moved a few steps closer. "You're not supposed to be here. This area is off-limits to passenger service crew." Still no answer. Then the engineer noticed a strange, misshapen lump pressed against the side of the fuel tank. Two strands of copper wire ran from it to a clock mechanism beside the duffel bag. "A bomb!" he blurted in shock. "You're planting a damn bomb!" He swung around and began running wildly down the walkway, shouting. He'd taken no more than 5 steps when the narrow steel confines echoed with a noise like twin hand claps in quick succession, and the hollow point bullets from a silenced automatic tore into the back of his head. The obligatory toasts were voiced, and the glasses of iced vodka downed and quickly refilled. Pekovsky did the honors from the liquor cabinet in his cabin, avoiding the cold, piercing gaze of the man seated on a leather sofa. Gaidar Ombrikov, chief of the KGB residency in Havana, was not in a congenial mood. "Your report won't sit well with my superiors," he said. "An agent lost under your command will be considered a clear case of negligence." "This is a cruise ship," Pekovsky said, his face reddening in resentment. "She was designed and placed in service for the purpose of bringing in hard Western currency for the Soviet treasury. We are not a floating headquarters for the Committee for State Security." "Then how do you explain the 10 agents our foreign directorate assigned on board your vessel to monitor the conversations of the passengers?"
"I try not to think about it."
"You should," Ombrikov said in a threatening tone. "I have enough to keep me busy running this ship," Pekovsky said quickly. "There aren't enough hours in my day to include intelligence gathering, too." "Still, you should have taken better precautions. If the American politicians escape and tell their story, the horrendous repercussions will have a disastrous effect on our foreign relations." Pekovsky set his vodka on the liquor cabinet without touching it. "There is no place they can hide for long on this ship. They will be back in our hands inside the hour." "I do hope so," said Ombrikov acidly. "Their navy will begin to wonder why a Soviet cruise liner is drifting around off their precious Cuban base and send out a patrol." "They wouldn't dare board the Leonid Andreev." "No, but my small pleasure boat is flying the United States flag. They won't hesitate to come aboard for an inspection."
"She's an interesting old boat," Pekovsky said, trying to change the subject.
"Where did you find her?" "A personal loan from our friend Castro," Ombrikov replied. "She used to belong to the author, Ernest Hemingway."
"Yes, I've read 4 of his books."
Pekovsky was interrupted by the sudden appearance of his first officer, who entered without knocking. "My apologies for breaking in, Captain, but may I have a word in private with you?" Pekovsky excused himself and stepped outside his cabin.
"What is it?"
"We failed to find them," the officer announced uneasily. Pekovsky paused for some moments, lit a cigarette in defiance of his own regulations, and gave his first officer a look of disapproval.
"Then I suggest you search the ship again, more carefully this time, and take a closer look at the passengers wandering the decks. They may be hiding in the crowd."
His first officer nodded and hurried off. Pekovsky returned to his cabin.
"Problems?" Ombrikov asked.
Before Pekovsky could answer, he felt a slight shudder run through the ship. He stood there curious for perhaps half a minute, tensed and alert, but nothing more seemed to happen.
Then, suddenly, the Leonid Andreev was rocked by a violent explosion that heeled her far over to starboard, flinging people off their feet and sending a convulsive shock wave throughout the ship. A great sheet of fire erupted from the port side of the hull, raining fiery steel debris and oil over the exposed decks. The blast reverberated over the water until it finally died away, leaving an unearthly silence in its wake, and a solid column of black smoke that mushroomed into the sky. What none of the 700 passengers and crew knew, what many of them would never come to learn, was that deep amidship the fuel tanks had detonated, blowing a gaping hole half above and half below the waterline, spraying a torrent of burning oil over the superstructure in blue and green flames, scarring the victims and blazing across the teak decks with the speed of a brush fire. Almost instantly, the Leonid Andreev was transformed from a luxurious cruise liner into a sinking, fiery pyre. Pitt stirred and wondered dully what had happened. For a full minute, as the shock wore off, he remained prone on the deck, where he'd been thrown by the force of the concussion, trying to orient himself. Slowly he rose to his hands and knees, then hoisted his aching body erect by grabbing the inner doorknob. Bruised but still functioning, nothing broken or out of joint, he turned to examine the others. Giordino was partly crouched, partly lying across the threshold of the shower stall. The last thing he remembered was sitting in the cabin. He wore a surprised look in his eyes, but he appeared unhurt. Moran and Lauren had fallen out of the bunks and were lying in the middle of the deck. They were both dazed and would carry a gang of black and blue marks for a week or two, but were otherwise uninjured. Larimer was huddled in the far corner of the cabin. Pitt went over and gently lifted his head. There was an ugly welt rising above the senator's left temple, and a trickle of blood dripped from a cut lip. He was unconscious but breathing easily. Pitt eased a pillow from the lower bunk under his head. Giordino was the first to speak. "How is he?" "Just knocked out," Pitt replied. "What happened?" Lauren murmured dazedly. "An explosion," said Pitt. "Somewhere forward, probably in the engine room." "The boilers?" Giordino speculated. "Modern boilers are safety designed not to blow." "God," said Lauren, "my ears are still ringing." A strange expression came over Giordino's face. He took a coin out of his pocket and rolled it across the hard-carpeted deck. Instead of losing its momentum and circling until falling on one side, it maintained its speed across the cabin as though propelled by an unseen hand and clinked into the far bulkhead. "The ship's listing," Giordino announced flatly. Pitt went over and cracked the door. Already the passageway was filling with passengers stumbling out of their cabins and wandering aimlessly in bewilderment. "So much for Plan B." Lauren gave him a quizzical look. "Plan B?" "My idea to steal the boat from Cuba. I don't think we're going to find seats." "What are you talking about?" Moran demanded. He rose unsteadily to his feet, holding on to a bunk chain for support. "A trick. It's a cheap trick to flush us out." "Damned expensive trick, if you ask me," Giordino said nastily. "The explosion must have seriously damaged the ship. She's obviously taking on water." "Will we sink?" Moran asked anxiously. Pitt ignored him and peered around the edge of the door again. Most of the passengers acted calm, but a few were beginning to shout and cry. As he watched, the passageway became clogged with people stupidly carrying armfuls of personal belongings and hastily packed suitcases. Then Pitt caught the smell of burning paint, quickly followed by the sight of a smoky wisp. He slammed the door and began tearing the blankets off the bunks and throwing them to Giordino. "Hurry, soak these in any towels you can find in the shower." Giordino took one look at Pitt's dead-serious expression and did as he was told. Lauren knelt and tried to lift Larimer's head and shoulders from the deck. The senator moaned and opened his eyes, looking up at Lauren as if trying to recognize her. Moran cringed against the bulkhead, muttering to himself. Pitt rudely pushed Lauren aside and lifted Larimer to his feet, slinging one arm around his shoulder. Giordino came out of the bathroom and distributed the wet blankets and towels. "All right, Al, you help me with the senator. Lauren, you hold on to Congressman Moran and stick close behind me." He broke off and looked at everyone. "Okay, here we go." He yanked open the door and was engulfed by a rolling wall of smoke that came out of nowhere. Almost before the explosion faded, Captain Pekovsky shook off stunned disbelief and rushed to the bridge. The young watch officer was pounding desperately on the automated ship console in agonized frustration. "Close all watertight doors and actuate the fire control system," Pekovsky shouted. "I can't," the watch officer cried helplessly. "We've lost all power." What about the auxiliary generators? They're out, too. The watch officer's face was wrapped in undisguised shock. The ship's phones are dead. The damage control computer is down. Nothing responds. We can't give a general alarm. Pekovsky ran out on the bridge wing and stared aft. His once beautiful ship was vomiting fire and smoke from her entire midsection. A few moments before, there was music and relaxed gaiety. Now the entire scene was one of horror. The open swimming pool and lounge decks had been turned into a crematorium. The 200 people stretched under the sun were almost instantly incinerated by the tidal fall of fiery oil. Some had saved themselves by leaping into the pools, only to die after surfacing for air when the heat seared their lungs, and many had climbed the railings and thrown themselves overboard, their skin and brief clothing ablaze. Pekovsky stood sick and stunned at the sight of the carnage. It was a moment in time borrowed from hell. He knew in his heart that his ship was lost. There was no stopping the Holocaust, and the list was increasing as the sea poured into the Leonid Andreev's bowels. He returned to the bridge. "Pass the word to abandon ship," he said to the watch officer. "The port boats are burning. Load what women and children you can into the starboard boat still intact." As the watch officer hurried off, the chief engineer, Eric Kazinkin, appeared, out of breath from his climb from below. His eyebrows and half his hair were singed away. The soles of his shoes were smoldering, but he appeared not to notice. His mind was numb to the pain.
"Give me a report," Pekovsky ordered in a quiet tone. "What caused the explosion?"
"The fuel tank blew," answered Kazinkin. "God knows why. Took out the power generating room and the auxiliary generator compartment as well. Boiler rooms 2 and 3 are flooded. We managed to manually close the watertight doors to the engine rooms, but she's taking on water at an alarming rate, and without power to operate the pumps..." He shrugged defeatedly without continuing. All options to save the Leonid Andreev had evaporated. The only morbid question was whether she would become a burned-out derelict or sink first. Few would survive the next hour, Pekovsky accepted with dread certainty. Many would burn and many would drown, unable to enter the pitifully few lifeboats that were still able to be launched. "Bring your men up from below," said Pekovsky. "We're abandoning the ship."
"Thank you, Captain," said the chief engineer. He held out his hand. "Good luck to you."
They parted, and Pekovsky headed for the communications room one deck below. The officer in charge looked up from the radio as the captain suddenly strode through the doorway. "Send out the distress call," Pekovsky ordered.
"I took the responsibility, sir, of sending out Mayday signals immediately after the explosion."
Pekovsky placed a hand on the officer's shoulder.
"I commend your initiative."
Then he asked calmly, "Have you managed to transmit without problem?"
"Yes, sir. When the power supply went off, I switched to the emergency batteries. The first response came from a Korean container ship only 10 miles to the southwest."
"Thank God someone is close. Any other replies?"
"The United States Navy at Guantanamo Bay is responding with rescue ships and helicopters. The only other vessel within 50 miles is a Norwegian cruise ship."
"Too late for her," said Pekovsky thoughtfully. "We'll have to pin our hopes on the Koreans and American Navy." With the soaked blanket over his head, Pitt had to feel his way along the passageway and up the smoke-filled staircase. 3-4 times he and Giordino tripped over the bodies of passengers who had succumbed to asphyxiation. Larimer made a game effort of trying to keep in step, while Lauren and Moran stumbled along behind, their hands clutching the belted trousers of Pitt and Giordino.
"How far?"
Lauren gasped.
"We have to climb 4 decks before we break out on the open promenade area," Pitt panted in reply.
At the second landing, they ran into a solid wall of people. The staircase became so packed with passengers struggling to escape the smoke, it became impossible to take another step. The crew acted with coolness, attempting to direct the human flow to the boat deck. But calm gave way to the inevitable contagion of panic, and they were trampled under the screaming, terror-driven mass of thrashing bodies.
"To the left!" Giordino shouted in Pitt's ear. "The passageway leads to another staircase toward the stern."
Relying on a deep trust in his little friend, Pitt veered down the passageway, pulling Larimer along. The senator finally managed to get his footing on the smooth surface and began carrying his own weight. To their vast relief, the smoke decreased, and the frightened tidal wave of people thinned. When at last they reached the aft staircase, they found it practically empty. By not following the herd instinct, Giordino had led them to temporary safety. They emerged in the clear on the deck aft of the observation lounge. After a few moments to ease their coughing spasms and cleanse their aching lungs with clean air, They looked in awe over the doomed ship. The Leonid Andreev was listing 20 degrees to port. Thousands of gallons of oil had spilled out into the sea and ignited. The water around the jagged opening caused by the blast was a mass of fire. The entire midsection of the ship was a blazing torch. The tremendous heat was turning steel plates red-hot and warping them into twisted, grotesque shapes. White paint was blistering black, teak decks were nearly burned through, and the glass in the portholes popped like gunshots. The flames spread with incredible speed as the ocean breeze fanned them toward the bridge. Already the communications room was consumed, and the officer in charge burned to death at his radio. Fire and swirling smoke shot upward through the companionways and ventilating ducts. The Leonid Andreev, like all modern cruise liners, was designed and constructed to be fireproof. But no precise planning or visionary foresight could have predicted the devastating results of a fuel tank explosion that showered the ship like a flamethrower. An immense billowing cloud of oily smoke reached hundreds of feet above, flattening in the upper air currents, stretching over the ship like a pall. The base of the cloud was a solid torrent of flame that twisted and surged in a violent storm of orange and yellow, while below, in the deeper reaches of the hull, the flames were an acetylene blue-white, fed into molten temperatures by the intake of air through the shattered plates, creating the effect of a blast furnace. Though many of the passengers were able to fight their way up the stairways, over 100 lay dead below, some trapped and burned in their cabins, others overtaken by smoke inhalation during their attempt to escape topside. The ones who made it were being driven by the flames toward the stern and away from the lifeboats. All efforts by the crew to maintain order were engulfed by the chaos. The passengers were finally left to fend for themselves, and no one knew which way to turn. All port lifeboats were ablaze, and only 3 were lowered on the starboard side before the fire drove the crew back. As it was, one boat was beginning to burn by the time it hit the sea. Now people began jumping into the water like migrating lemmings. The drop was nearly 50 feet, and a number of those who had life jackets made the mistake of inflating them before plummeting over the side and broke their necks on impact. Women stood spellbound in terror, too frightened to leap. Men cursed in desperation. In the water, the swimmers struck out for the few lifeboats, but the crews who manned them started up the engines and sailed beyond reach for fear of being swamped by overloading. In the middle of the frenzied drama, the container ship arrived. The captain eased his vessel within 100 yards of the Leonid Andreev and put his boats over as fast as they could be lowered. A few minutes later, U.S. Navy Sea Rescue helicopters appeared and began plucking survivors from the sea.